This is Free Speech Radio News, a special for this New Year's Day, January 1st of the year 2003. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Today we invite you to join us on an odyssey that takes us from deep inside Zapatista rebel territory with the biodiversity of the rainforests of Mexico's southeast, through maquiladoras in Central America, and finally making the last leg of the perilous journey, illegally, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border in search of work on the streets of San Francisco. FSRN's Chiapas team, Mariana Mora, Luz Ruiz, and Tim Russo, bring us this special documentary.
From the depths of the Lacandon jungle in the southeast corner of Mexico, 9 years ago today, the Zapatistas emerged from a forgotten history to become the vanguard of resistance in the face of free trade economic policies set on building a global fiefdom for U.S.-based transnational corporations.
This plan is nothing like what Fox says. It is the worst image that you could construct of a banana republic. A brutal looting of nature, a brutal exploitation of the people that signifies one way or the other, whirling back the hands of time to the history of colonial Mexico, when destroying anything that there was to destroy didn't matter if the destruction meant profits. When to annihilate hundreds of thousands of human beings didn't matter if it signified profits. This is what Plan Puebla Panama is fundamentally about.
President Vicente Fox's presidential project for his six-year term, Plan Puebla Panama, is the most ambitious macroeconomic infrastructure project proposed for Mexico and Central America in decades. Fox has vowed to push forward Plan Puebla Panama at all costs, despite broadening resistance from opposition parties, non-governmental organizations, Mexican and Central American civil society, indigenous peoples throughout Mesoamerica, and more than a dozen guerrilla groups currently active throughout the region. 2002 became a year for organizing around concerns about Plan Puebla Panama that include deciphering its true objectives, who the greatest benefactors will be, and just what the real cost to traditional cultures, average Mexicans and Central Americans, will constitute. Florencio Salazar, President Fox's handpicked coordinator for the development and implementation of Plan Puebla Panama, tends to speak with confidence as to what the official goals are designed to achieve.
It is an initiative by President Vicente Fox in order to generate the regional sustainable development in 9 Mexican states. This document suggests well-defined actions to generate economic development in the area in the form of physical infrastructures, prioritizing 2 central highways. One is on the Gulf Coast, another on the Pacific Coast, and a highway uniting the two in the Tehuantepec Isthmus. We are also considering the modernization of airports and railways located in this area and the construction of 2 major hydroelectric plants.
Living in Mexico City, Carlos Facio is a political analyst and a frequent contributor to Mexico's renowned daily publication La Jornada.
This is the official Plan Puebla Panama, but others think that we are dealing with a much more ambitious project, not for the benefit of the poorest, the indigenous campesinos, but more in the interests of the multinational companies, national as well as international, because in the southeastern part of Mexico there are huge resources, oil, uranium, and there's water, which will be indeed the objective of the next wars in the 21st century. There's biodiversity, and there are a number of elements that for a long time have been attractive to the multinational companies. This is the development that they will bring to the south. Together with this, there exists a second element that is designed to transform the complete area of the south-southeastern part of Mexico into an export sector from the USA to Asia. The great secret of the maquiladoras is that the Mexican workers are much cheaper than the North Americans. In the USA, they pay $9 an hour for this kind of work, and in Mexico, the salary is maybe $9 a day. But at the moment, the maquilas in the north are threatening to leave to other places, where labor is even cheaper, to Central America or to Asia. Fox's plan is to offer the multinational companies the cheapest labor force in the world, the Maya Indians. The advantage for Mexico would be then the low salaries that are without competition. For the investors, this would be most attractive.
Subcomandante Marcos, spokesman for the ragtag Zapatista National Liberation Army that stunned the world when it took up arms in Chiapas the very day that NAFTA went into effect, summed up the situation that Fox's project faces with just a few words during an interview on the historic rebel caravan to Mexico City.
Yeah. No va a haber Plan Puebla Panamá en territorio zapatista.
There is not going to be any Plan Puebla Panamá in Zapatista territory. They will have to turn around, go back, and then continue along on the other side. And not only that, I dare to say that in a lot of other indigenous areas, the same thing will happen.
Carlos Facio explains the significance.
The Zapatista caravan passed through the Isthmus of Tehuantepec on the way to Mexico City and exclaimed that the Isthmus of Tehuantepec is not for sale, and that they did not want a destiny for the indigenous people that meant serving in the maquilas. The Zapatista struggle for land under the old models of Zapata, Tierra y Libertad, land and freedom, and La Tierra es de quien la trabaja, the land belongs to the ones that cultivate it, is a theme related to the campesinos. There are no campesinos without land. The immense project of the PPP tries to take away land from the campesinos, to annihilate the connection to the land in order to make them paid workers with the lowest salaries in the world. This is the new wave that the multinational and agricultural companies produce. They need access to huge areas, so the plan is to empty the south-southeastern region of the campesinos, transform them into slave workers with slave wages, and then let the multinationals take over their land.
Norman Davis, president of Sucahuala, National Association of Mayanás Peoples in Nicaragua, is living proof of the internationally spreading of indigenous resistance.
The only thing we are saying is that all indigenous peoples are in a fight for collective property, and we don't want any political or economic impositions whatsoever. Those are things that are already being implemented because the Nicaraguan government is receiving a lot of pressure from the World Bank, IMF, and the International Development Bank to exclude us from economic competition. The Plan Puebla Panamá will only be an extension of this, and it is impossible for indigenous peoples to compete with multimillionaire business companies. The same thing is happening with indigenous property because certain juridical concessions are made that are going to affect indigenous peoples.
Amado Ordóñez, a spokesperson from the Humboldt Center, a Nicaraguan environmental group that helped coordinate the Foro Managua, one of a series of forums that were held between Mexico City and Panama this year as organizing efforts against free trade policies they are faced with, explained that one of the primary reasons for the forums was the exploration of different struggles being waged by communities in the face of the Plan Puebla Panamá and neoliberal globalization.
In Guatemala's case, the struggle was product of land issues and the construction of a dam that campesinos and indigenous people oppose. We also examined the Honduran Union struggle, the Costa Rican fight for privatization of industry and telecommunication services. Organizations have advanced in the sense that we have been making proposals and strongly mobilizing at the same time in order to reject issues of policies that people in the forum's participants view as impositions from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and that the only thing they have brought us is poverty, a bigger gap between rich and poor, leaving us no other option but to raise our voices.
True and open popular referendums seem unlikely, and government-led conflict resolution appears to be secondary in most cases. In regards to the 9-year-old conflict in Chiapas, Mexico's PPP whip, Mr. Salazar, has explained the government's official view on the matter.
We see Plan Puebla Panamá as a regional development plan. As a consequence, it does not depend on the signing of a peace agreement.
Carlos Facio again helps to paint the picture with the unspoken motivations behind the Plan Puebla Panamá, often kept behind closed doors.
In 1995, 96, and again in 1997, when the army went into Chiapas, it was not only in the Zapatista areas, but in all of Chiapas. The army formed a series of bases that cover the complete area, but some of the camps are connected to the existence of oil, water, uranium, and in the Lacandon jungle, connected to biodiversity.
Throughout December of 2002, heavy rumors circulated that Tseltal women and men living in the ecological reserve of Montes Azules in the Lacandon jungle region of the state of Chiapas, Mexico, would be forcefully removed from their lands.
But we are not illegal. We also have legal rights, as International Labor Organization Treaty says. We have rights as indigenous peoples to these lands. We fought for these lands. What the government wants is to kick us off so the companies can use the resources and make us work for the maquiladoras.
For the past 4 years, 40 communities in this region have lived under constant threat of expulsion, and every winter season, they brace themselves for a possible violent confrontation with Mexican authorities. The Mexican government, aligned with several conservative environmental organizations, such as the World Wildlife Fund, blames the local indigenous population for destroying the majority of the Lacandon jungle area. At the same time, Mexico's environmental agency has met with private companies such as Nestle and Bristol-Myers to help co-manage the reserve with the government. This recent shift highlights a deeply seated assumption that those who would economically benefit from its conservation would be more prone to take care of the environment. Members of these communities, such as Efraín from La Culebra, believe otherwise.
Esos proyectos es apoyado por...
The government wants to bring different projects that are supported by companies interested in the resources of the jungle. They look at the communities that live here as a threat. They want us to leave. It is urgent for them.
Mexico ranks fourth in countries with the highest level of biodiversity, 10% of which is concentrated in the Lacandon jungle. While local communities consider this richness to belong to all of humanity, transnational corporations see tremendous economic potential and are willing to support even violent measures to ensure that they gain access to the resources found here.
The transnationals arrive in such a way that they aren't easily identified, such as through investigators that are searching for germplasm or for the genetic makeup of plants and animals. It's a type of research whose final objective is always commercial and is typically sponsored by transnationals that seek to extract those resources, but do so first by tapping into local knowledge of the plants.
Ana Valadez, advisor to the Coordination of Organizations of Mayan Doctors and Midwives, COMPICH, explains how the process of bioprospecting depends on local knowledge, but rarely recognizes those who carry that knowledge and have passed it on for generations.
Eso nosotros lo hemos llamado biopiratería.
We call this biopiracy because it is a robbery disguised as resources for poor communities. These plants are then used for biotechnology and the agro-industrial or pharmaceutical industries. They can convert a plant into medicine or use it for the biological control of plagues, all of which largely serve to target diseases of the first world and to feed the first world. The objective isn't to eradicate diseases or respond to the agroecological problems of the third world. It's to solve the problems of the first world.
3 years ago, the Mayan doctors and midwives of COMPICH were robbed of their medicinal knowledge by the ICGB Maya Project, a partnership between the Chiapas-based research institute, ECOSUR, the University of Georgia in Atlanta, and a UK-based pharmaceutical company. Arturo Gomez, member of COMPICH, tells the story of what happened.
They told us that they were going to gather plants for a study, and that information they would later bring back to the community. But it wasn't like that. They lied to us. They would give us a tiny bit of money so that the people in the community would keep gathering the plants for them. When COMPICH saw that that project wasn't to our benefit, that it was all a lie and that it was a form of exploitation, then we had to find a way to make them understand that it wasn't right and send them back to their country.
At the bottom of this struggle between local indigenous communities and private companies is a debate over ownership and rights to resources. International economic agreements, like NAFTA, limit ownership and intellectual property rights to individuals and stipulate that knowledge can be bought and sold. Francisca, a Tzeltal herbalist and COMPICH representative, thinks differently.
The only owner of knowledge is God, because he is the one that gave us that knowledge. My grandmother was a midwife, and, well, it was the knowledge that God gave her. He gave her those skills and showed her what to do through her dreams. What I know doesn't belong to me, it belongs to nature.
Arturo adds,
pues, como comunidad,
we can't sell a plant just like that because it doesn't belong to only one person. It belongs to the community. We have to decide amongst all of us to see what to do with those plants, what the impact will be if we sell those plants.
Exerting greater control over local resources and knowledge has been met with heavy criticism and blatant racism. In February of 2002, Francisca was invited as part of COMPICH to a meeting of the environmental ministries of countries with megadiversity in the tourist city of Cancun. She went to show the guidelines of COMPICH and the organization's agreements to not allow the patenting of plants found in their region.
The businessman told me that I was stupid and don't know anything, and then they wouldn't talk to me anymore, and they even left me without food, and I had no way of getting back home. I cried because as indigenous people we are marginalized and they don't respect us. They just want our plants.
While on one hand stating that their use of biodiversity promotes environmental conservation, transnational corporations interested in patenting and in creating genetically modified plant varieties are facilitating the very destruction of those varieties they so verbally support. The case of the spread of genetically modified corn in Mexico is a devastating example. Global Exchange's Chiapas-based Ryan Zinn has been working extensively on biodiversity and issues of genetically contaminated corn in Mexico.
What we're seeing right now is an attempt by the Fox government to convert the Mexican countryside away from basic crops like corn to more cash crops for agro-export. And what this means is this is an absolute threat and attack on indigenous communities and camp communities here in Mexico, because the culture, the people, the land, most of the agriculture is based around corn. And so once you take that away from the people, either economically or in this case the genetic contamination, what that does is really impulse a breakdown in the social fabric of the country.
Over 10,000 years ago, corn was domesticated in Mexico by native peoples. The country is considered a center of genetic diversity by natural scientists because thousands of corn varieties are grown by peasants and indigenous people. Of the more than 3 million peasants producing 18 million tons of corn annually, 70% grow native varieties. Otelina from the Tzeltal community of Francisco Gomez, located in the larger Lacandon jungle region, explains the importance of corn to her culture.
El maíz que...
We have different colors. Some are white and yellow. These grow in the fields. And then the ones that are darker, that are brown and black, grow in the mountains. Those are different. The white ones don't last very long, but the yellow and the red, which also grows in the fields, last longer. The black one makes pozole change color, and the flavor is a little bit different. We use all of these varieties.
Ryan explains how this richness has been severely threatened under the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Under NAFTA, what we saw was the establishment of a quota system where Mexico was only allowed to import a minimal quantity of corn from the United States to be able to satisfy internal consumption. What happened was, since the beginning of 1994, that was in fact violated. So the United States is dumping corn or selling corn to Mexico under the price of production.
In the Lacandon and Highland regions of Chiapas, community members have found genetically modified corn in stores and in their cornfields. Juan, a local producer and member of Compich, explains what happens when genetically modified corn is grown.
Otros paisanos empezaron a utilizar fertilizantes.
Some people I know began to plant the short corn, but that one isn't ours. It's what the government gave us, but it doesn't grow again. Every time we have to buy more from the store, and that corn has no strength. We make it in tortillas, and after a little while we are hungry again. It isn't the same.
The contamination of genetically modified corn is irreversible. Arturo is clear about the potential destruction of genetic diversity and the precarious existence lived by these indigenous communities.
El medio ambiente.
We feel that the environment is the only thing we have left, and that is that which protects us. And they are the only resources left, and if those people doing research come and we don't protect what we have, then they will be the owners and we will end up working for them.
Despite organizing efforts, grim conditions in the Mexican countryside have taken their toll on small farmers. Ryan explains the harsh outcome of this situation.
What we can see, not so much in the state of Chiapas, but other corn-producing states like Jalisco and Morelos and Oaxaca, is that corn producers are now being forced to the cities or to migrate to the United States as a result of not having a guaranteed market for their national corn output.
I've traveled all of California for 20 years now. For me, it's very common that on any given day at 4 in the evening, I just hop across to Tijuana, go to El Nido de las Águilas, and jump across the mountain, or just cross the Mexicali Channel and get on my way, even barefoot because the river is very violent, without a shirt or pants.
Lorenzo, who came to the United States from Cuernavaca, Morelos, in Mexico, is one of the thousands of men and women who embark on an uncertain and dangerous voyage into the north with hopes of earning dollars to send back home to their families. With at least 24.5 million citizens of Mexican origin, out of which 10 million were born in Mexico and 4 million do not have naturalization documents, the United States has become a magnet of south to north migration. An acute agricultural crisis deepened by the push of small-scale family farming into industrialized and urban job sectors, along with development expansion in rural Mexico, has forced farmers to either move to the city or take the long jump into the United States. Oftentimes, they encounter the reality that cities have become no different, as the hardships of working for a minimum wage in their home countries has obliged them to migrate north, passing through a series of trials and tribulations in order to find a job opportunity. Lorenzo talks more about the experience.
We get here and instinctively begin to search. Some say it's intelligence, I say it's instinct. You bump into the guys on the streets and ask where work is, and they tell you in which corner, and that's sort of how it works. The first day I got here, I didn't beg, I spent. I invited this one man for a beer to investigate where work could be found, how to get it. In every city, there's a corner where you can get hired to work. So he took me to Chavez Street, formerly Army, on 26th.
Cesar Chavez Street is a long strip along the Mission District, a predominantly Latino area in San Francisco, California. On any given day, primarily undocumented men from Mexico and Latin American countries line the sidewalks awaiting for an opportunity to work. Carlos, who came from Mexico City 3 years ago, stands every day on this street waiting for a job.
I work in different kinds of construction, painting, taping, sanding, those kinds of things. Demolition work, too. I come here to work on the street 6 days a week and work four on average. I make about $300, $350 a week. Of course, there are weeks when I hardly get work and others when I work a lot. It's money that allows me to get by and work that lets me learn things. But I believe that a moment will come when I will be able to get a stable job. That's why I'm waiting here.
Free trade agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and development projects like the Plan Puebla Panamá have created deplorable working conditions throughout Mexico and Central America. Lorenzo compares work north and south of the border.
In Mexico, I worked every week and earned about 300 pesos. That's $30. Here, I work one day and sometimes earn up to $150 and immediately send over 1,000 pesos. These $100 that I earned that day would be equivalent to 4 weeks of work over there. I just keep $20 to eat until more work comes, but the wage difference is brutal. It is definitely brutal.
Last week I worked 4 days. This week I don't know how many I'll work.
Mario from Guanajuato, Mexico, is another day laborer who waits for work on Cesar Chavez Street. His words echo those of many undocumented workers who, despite police and community harassment and lack of job security on the streets, a good majority prefer to look for work in the United States than suffer the results of failing economic policies in their countries. Andres Figueroa from Nayarit, Mexico, has been living 5 years in San Francisco and is now a member of the San Francisco Day Labor Program, a nonprofit community service and empowerment center in San Francisco, California. Amidst the ambiguity and insecurity of the streets, the program offers a safe and useful option.
It's a lot better here because of the legal advice, to have legal representation. On the street you can find more work, but you are under your own risk, and here you're not. You are at greater risk of being contracted and taken away to a far place and being dumped in the middle of the road without getting paid. Because this has happened with several others. They take them to work for a day or two, and then the employers tell them that they'll pay later. And very innocently, the workers don't even take note of their license plates or the home address where he's working, just by faith and word, they go to work, hoping they'll get paid, and then they never do.
All decisions about program policy are made by workers at their weekly meetings, providing a space where the workers can build up their leadership skills. Currently, they are working to have a permanent space on Cesar Chavez Street. The city of San Francisco has not yet taken any of the necessary measures to respond to this need for the workers, making the day laborers mobilize and hold a series of events and rallies to pressure current mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, to keep funding and supply a space for the day labor program. Lorenzo Tlapamatl, head of a six-member family and a day laborer, took to the microphone in order to explain their situation.
Estoy aquí para solicitar
con todo respeto que se merece esta ciudad.
I'm here to ask of the city, with all the respect that the city deserves, the following things. We ask for the permission to have our building on Cesar Chavez Street so that we can have classes of English and work training classes. We also are asking that the city give us our funding to run the day labor program so that we can continue having this La Raza Centro Legal administering the program.
In the small trailers the day labor program has its offices, René Saucedo, director of the San Francisco day labor program, explains how city measures disguisingly try to keep order on the streets as a way of intimidating day labor organizing.
What they've been doing is using police here to ticket day laborers for minor traffic violations, loitering, stepping off the sidewalk, getting them for jaywalking, things like that, citing the employers for double parking. And they have been moving them illegally off of public sidewalks, even though they're not doing anything illegal. And this typically happens in response to a neighbor who just doesn't like having to see them in front of their home, so they call the cops. The cops come by and say, move it, even though they're not doing anything illegal.
Frank Taylor, a neighbor who lives close to Cesar Chavez Street, responded to the bashing of day laborers made by angry and hostile neighbors that call police on them.
I live on 26 in Florida, a block from Cesar Chavez. A few people have hijacked the word neighbor to mean someone who opposes the day laborers. I'm a neighbor and I support the day laborers. A handful of these anti-day labor neighbors say, oh, the day laborers create traffic, and then suddenly you've got a police state out there with people ticketing day laborers for walking off the sidewalk. This is hypocrisy. Thank you.
Organizing efforts from the Latino community and undocumented workers throughout the United States has paved the way for future immigrants facing the hardships of undocumented life. So Saucedo recalls the possibilities of a positive outcome for the legal suit.
We stand a very good chance to win because a federal court has already determined that day laborers in Los Angeles have a First Amendment right to stand on public sidewalks, and the city can't keep them from doing it under the First Amendment.
Back on Cesar Chavez Street, workers like Carlos, Pancho, Andres, Mario, and Lorenzo are still waiting to get a job. Their long waits on the sidewalks have made many accuse them of being lazy and idle. They explain what they are really doing.
They look at us standing on the corners and they think those poor devils don't even have a place to lie dead. They are just little parasites. And they see this like a game. They make fun of us. It's sad and a huge offense what they are saying to us. We are just here waiting for a job. Everybody knows the sidewalks are to wait for work, not to sell drugs or drink.
It involves a lot of sacrifice and abstinence from a lot of things that you want. Secondary things, really, because food, clothing, they are necessary. But entertainment or things like that, you have to restrain yourself. You limit yourself on some things in order to achieve others. We are all here to work to be able to provide well-being to our families, mostly economically. Better our situation because the majority of our countries have a very bad economy. And I believe we all come here with the purpose of doing something, of bettering ourselves.
Free Speech Radio News' Chiapas team, Mariana Mora, Luz Ruiz, and Tim Russo, with that special documentary presentation. For a copy of the show, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org. We'll be back with our regular newscast tomorrow. I'm Deepa Fernandez.